When the farmer comes to town with his wagon loaded down, the farmer is the man who feeds them all. If you'll only look and see, I'm sure you will agree, the farmer is the man who feeds them all. The farmer is the man, the farmer is the man, lives on credit till the fall. Then they take him by the hand and they lead him from the land. And the middleman's the man that gets it all.
1861 had been a bad year. Crops had failed. It had been a dry year. And it looked to be a lot better in 1862. Actually, the relationship between the government, the whites, and the Dakota people were pretty good. But as 1862 wore on, the effects of 1861 begin to be felt more and more.
Some of the Indians, if not most of them, didn't think they were going to be paid. The late annuity was another immediate primary cause. The annuities by treaty were due about July 1st. And by August 18th, the annuity still hadn't been paid.
And finally, Dakota people gathered at the Upper Sioux demanding that the agent Galbraith release the food stores. Eventually, under threats from them, he did. Then they went to Lower Sioux shortly thereafter, once again hoped for the food to be dispersed. This time, the agent Galbraith said, no, you're not going to get it. Go off into the prairies and hunt. We're going to wait for the money. And one of the traders, story goes, then said, if you're so hungry, eat grass. That was like a slap in the face to the Dakota people. And angry Indians went on to the prairie then to hunt. And as they were returning from that hunt, that's when these four young men killed the five at Acton.
Here's the scene that summer of 1862. The Dakota people have been split into two groups. The Mittawakaton and Wapakuta at the lower agency near present-day Redwood Falls, Minnesota, and the Sisseton and Wahpeton located at the upper agency near the mouth of the Yellow Medicine River. Little Crow is a strong leader for the lower agency, and a Dakota farmer named Gabriel Renville is a strong leader for the upper agency. Renville has seen that the sea of settlers will not be stopped, and based on his personal values, has adapted to farming as a way to feed his family. Little Crow's values are more traditionally based, and his desire is to continue life as it has always been. He sees the settlers as a locust that can't be stopped. The newcomers continue to stream in, all speaking different languages, but creating small settlements and farming the land. Abraham Lincoln and the U.S. government are preoccupied with the war against slavery, which is splitting the American soul. There is a military presence in southern Minnesota, but not a large one, Fort Ridgely and Fort Snelling. Although the crops in the field are looking fine, the previous year had been a bad one. Food is scarce. The Dakota people come to receive their food supplies and are told that they cannot be released until the bill is paid. The people are hungry. The immigrants are now farming, logging, and using resources that once belonged entirely to the Dakota people. There is no clear split between the Dakotas and the newcomers. In fact, there are many reports that these very different nations were coming to terms with one another, finding their common humanity. As in communities across the world, there are smooth slopes and rocky roads.
I had heard a story in my family about a settler family that would put their baked goods on the windowsill to cool, bread, pies, and that this was viewed as a gift, that it was put on the windowsill. And so the Dakota family that lived close by, the man in the family would take a loaf of bread or take a pie, but would leave a rabbit or would leave something else in exchange. And that relationship carried on for quite some time. And that was a story that I had heard in my family.
The government, they hadn't been treated too good. The government didn't live up to the treaty. And they knew a cold winter was coming, and the money for buying the food was delayed. Another example of government bureaucracy. And the federal government was involved in a civil war, and they had all that going on. So That's probably what started the unrest.
In the fall of 1861, the government sent George E. H. Day to look into claims of fraud in the implementation of the treaties. Had the government acted on his report, things might have been different.
They sent George E. H. Day over to investigate this, what was going on here. And so when he came to our Dakota people, of course our Dakota people said, finally. So when they talked to our Dakota people, they told their story. And from that process, this is the most significant element at that time for our Dakota people to have this investigation so that there would be no war. And so George E. H. Day investigated, and sure enough, he found all the frauds, the violations of law from the agents and the superintendents, all the connection from Minnesota up to Washington as to who would get paid so and how much they would get paid, all of that. And that's where he found the frauds.
And then a tragedy happened. Sandy Gishick, a member of the Midewakanton Band, tells the story.
On August 17th, 1862, there were some young men that were sent out probably to hunt for food. They came upon this farm near Acton, Minnesota, and they did take some eggs that didn't belong to them. And then, one thing led to the other. They challenged each other. You know, are you going to be a coward? And, not admit to the farm. I guess what happened is the farmer caught them, and then they challenged each other. Well, are you going to stand up to this man? And they did.
But suddenly, these four Indians killed three men, a woman, and a 15-year-old girl. They fled immediately. They didn't mutilate the bodies. They didn't take anything. They knew the first house had liquor, and they didn't stop long enough to take the liquor. But they stopped to kill a 15-year-old girl at that first house. And they fled back to their community, Rice Creek Village, immediately.
Then they went back, and the news spread in the lower agency. The Upper Sioux agency didn't know anything about this, so that shows how hostilities start small, escalate fast.
They approached Little Crow and asked him, are you going to be a coward and just let, the army do whatever they have to us? And he told him, he said, no. He said, Ta Oyate Duta is not a coward, and he will die, right alongside you. So it was those words that basically said, that he would declare war. He would, stand up for what was done to his people. It started here at the Lower Sioux Agency, then at Redwood Ferry on August 19th through the 21st, and eventually Birch Coulee. Birch Coulee was September 2nd, 1862. Within the Dakota-United States War of 1862, the only battle that our warriors won was the Battle of Birch Coulee. They planned how they were going to attack, and they were successful at it.
Sylvan Schumacher was born in Leavenworth Township near Sleepy Eye, Minnesota.
There was two men trying to get to New Almanault once they saw the Indians in the background. So the one of them crawled up in a tree, and the other one had his dog along. So there was a slough over there, so he went with his dog over there, and he watched from there, and all at once he said they had seen the two of them there, and they seen this guy go up in the tree, so they come and they shot him He had his dog and he started to bark. And he couldn't let the dog bark, so he had around his dog. And then when he saw him getting close to the slough, he had found a reed and he breathed through there until he could not last any longer. And when he come up, they had left and then he made it to New Orleans.
As the war escalated between the soldiers with their new recruits and the Dakota warriors, a second war was happening between two separate factions of the Dakota, the Sisseton-Wahpetons and the Mittawakatons. Some were involved in the fighting, and others were protecting the white people.
One day, I think there was about seven or eight young boys on horseback came through here and told the people to leave. So then they started to leave. And this Eric Johnson, who lives on this farm here, they were intercepted, and they were hiding in the meadow under hay stacks. And then in that activity, the mother and one of the boys were shot and were killed. They warned quite a few, told them to leave. And for some reason, they ended up shooting this lady and the young boy. He was 12 years old. So that type of news got people excited.
When the Soldiers' Lodge declared war, other men joined. Others were forced to join by threat of death. The opposition to Little Crow increased, and they were plotting. Chief Gabriel Rembrandt was among those who were planning how to take these hostages away from Little Crow and how might they link with General Sibley's army. And they saw their opportunity when Little Crow and his followers went to Camp Release. They secured the hostages into their teepees. They started digging holes in the center of the teepees, which was a standard Dakota defense against their enemies. And these brave men were prepared to defend these hostages with their lives if Little Crow tried to take them back. Gabriel Rembrandt was one of these people.
Well, I think that both, you know, Little Crow and Gabriel Rembrandt were related. And even so, if they continued on the path they were, we would have had a civil war among our own people. And I think both Gabriel and Little Crow knew this. And I think at the final, at the conclusion of that, after the Battle of Wood Lake, when Little Crow come back and found out that his captives had been taken and were going to be protected and defended, he knew that if he did go back and try to get them back, that there was going to be an all-out war between the two bands. And I think Little Crow, because of that, looked and knew that, you know, he had relatives, relationships on both sides, and decided that he didn't want to see that happen. And he called an end to the war.
The war lasted just 6 weeks. The cited number of casualties vary. Somewhere between 400 to 800 settlers were dead. The numbers uncertain because many simply fled the area. The number of Dakotas dead from the war listed at 150 to 180, but those numbers increased dramatically in the aftermath, including the 38 Dakota men tried and hung in Mankato.
Yeah, much of them, I mean, one of the immediate impacts of the war is that much of the western two-thirds of Minnesota was depopulated. They just left, you know, never to come back. There are various estimates, but we'll never know really how many died because many disappeared, just leaving the state, never to come back, and no one knows really what happened to them.
Right now I'm saying that more than 100 were killed as a result of war. 38 hanged in Mankato. 130 died in the internment camp at Fort Snelling. And hundreds more died after the war in the Davenport prison and at Crow Creek.
There were soldiers, like at Redwood Ferry, who were killed in pitched battles. There were soldiers at Birch Coulee that were killed in pitched battles. I think there were a lot of civilians that were killed along the way as well. I don't think that there was a lot of rape. I think that anytime you're talking about conflict between different ethnic groups, rape gets brought up a lot. So I think that it happens. I think in the instance of the Dakota War, if it happened at all, it happened only a couple times.
Following the end of the fighting, 2,000 Dakota people surrendered and came into Camp Release with the promise from Sibley that they would be treated humanely. Another broken promise. In truth, the government decided that the solution was to remove the Dakota people from Minnesota entirely.
In general, the white community in Minnesota was not very happy, to put it mildly, with the Dakota after the War of 1862. So I would suspect that the newspaper editors in the Mankato papers and the other 100 or so around the state, it seems pretty clear, were probably inflaming the public, but the public mind was already inflamed.
2,000 people surrendered, thinking that they would be treated humanely as prisoners of war. And actually, those 2,000 people gathered at Camp Release and waited for Sibley to show up, thinking they would be treated humanely as prisoners of war. They were force-marched 150 miles the second week of November in 1862. 150 miles, it took 7 days. Women, children, old people.
Judith Anniwash is an enrolled member of the Sisseton-Wahpeton Sioux tribe.
All of them, when the soldiers came, they were just running, scattering, trying to find some place of safety, but she must have had, I suppose, arthritis and all the things that attack you when you're old. And the soldiers were coming and they were chasing all the people. She fell and they were all running and screaming. She couldn't get up. And I suppose everybody was in such a panic and all that. They were all running by her, and they remember her saying, "Just help me up. If you can just help me up, I know that I can run," you know. And they all ran back, you know, past her, and one of them must have turned around and looked, and the soldiers were all surrounding her, and they had their guns pointed at her, and they must have killed her, you know, but I can't imagine anything worse, you know, than having to leave her behind, you know, but what else could you do? They survived, and because they survived, we're here today.
When nations go to war, all the people suffer. In the aftermath of the 1862 war, the Dakota people were split against one another. The white settlers were fleeing for their lives. Who was guilty and who was innocent? What seems clear is that the settlers were caught in the middle between the U.S. government and the Dakota Nation. What's also clear is that many innocent Dakota people were caught in the backlash. Innocence and guilt. Values, beliefs, and a clash of cultures. Family. Tradition.
There are three conditions that you face that are difficult situations, and you can look at them like a storm, and you can deal with it either like the chicken does or like the eagle. In other words, the eagle will see a storm coming, sees the crowd gathering, a storm approaching. He can sense, he could feel it. A storm approach, and he reacts by becoming excited, you know, and he'll set up on a post or something and wait for the storm, facing into it. And when the storm hits, all he's got to do is re-lift up his wings, and the storm catches him and takes him up and up, and pretty soon he's flying above the storm. That's one approach.
It is impossible to set aside war. It does not seem to pass into distant memory like the breakfast you ate this morning or the car you drove 10 years ago. The hurt, the pain, the anger stays present from one generation to another for all who were connected to those who died. What we can do is to try to learn something about ourselves, about what happened, how it happened. We can try to fly like an eagle above the blood and the terror and see once again how utterly human we are and how utterly animal we are. When trapped, we will chew off our own foot. We can seek to understand, to let go, to move forward. 150 years have passed since some young men stole some eggs, or whatever it was that triggered the 1862 war. It had little to do with eggs and everything to do with an historical avalanche. In order to understand better, we have to shift our lens to consider things from three different perspectives: the nature of war, the nature of human beings, and the nature of racism, the place where basic survival needs twist into something ugly. First, the nature of war.
Because war is all they do. They create three armies. One is you create an army of cripples. You create an army of mourners. And you create an army of criminals. And that's what war gives you.
You know, it would be the same as the United States involved in that Afghan, in the wars today. How can they try them for murder when it was one nation against the other?
So it was a war. Bad things happened. I think you can look at instances where women and children on both sides were killed.
Look back at the Civil War. Over 500,000 white men killing each other. How savage is that?
In today's conflict, I think if you take a group of people, you subjugate them, you don't give them access to any opportunities, you tell them that their lives are worth less than other people, sooner or later, some of them don't value human life.
Secondly, the nature of human beings.
I think Gabriel had in mind the overall welfare of the people, you know, to seeing, doing what he could to see that they had a better way of life, you know. Anything was better than what they were doing. But I think what he looked at and said, the worst thing, the only thing worse than the way we're living is to go have a war.
And that process of being disempowered, disenfranchised, owned, made into tenants, does something to the mind in that you become like an aspirer, right? You want to be the owner and not the owned, and so you start to do things to other people. And, you know, the Inquisition was a kind of genocide, you know, eradicating a spiritual, you know, religious group.
Whereas I think the Little Crow group were focused on one thing, the dirty, rotten way we've been treated, and we're going to do something about this. And they, and irregardless of what it's going to do to these people or these people here, or even the settlers, you know, they're as much to blame as anybody, and we're going to go after them too, you know. And so I think they had a narrow view of the whole situation. They were not considering what was going to happen. And they were even told, Little Crow even told them, you know, that what was going to happen.
I mean, look, if I was a farmer and my 10-year-old was killed, would I fight back? Of course I would fight back. Of course.
And then the next image that comes to my mind is the image at Fort Snelling where Bishop Whipple is presiding over a huge bonfire where the Dakota people who were at the prison camp were burning their sacred bundles. To me, that sounds like conversion, conditional conversion. Do you want to live? Do you want to survive? That's one of the reasons I think we today, whether we're Dakota people or anybody, I don't think we can judge the actions of our ancestors because they did what they had to do to survive.
I completely understand that. How do you completely give up your way of life, lose not just the place where you live, but the place where your ancestors have lived for generations and generations, and go to someplace else and feel like a complete human being? So I can understand why, despite all of the circumstances and all of the odds against them, that Dakota people did return to Minnesota.
Finally, the nature of racism.
You know, we can't look at 1863 or 1862 entirely from our lens today. I mean, there are many things that are not socially acceptable now that were then, or vice versa. But you can't get away from the fact that, I mean, there was an incredible amount of racism, and Dakota people and other people of color were not worth as much as regular, quote-unquote, Euro-Americans.
America has a love-hate relationship with Indians. For some reason, everybody wants to be Indian, especially when money is involved. But you turn right around and everybody hates them. They get special rights. They don't have to pay to go to school. They don't pay taxes, all of which are lies.
I think there was an extreme amount of racism. I think that people genuinely felt in their hearts that if Indian people were to be saved, that it wasn't going to be through continuing to practice traditional cultures and beliefs, that Indian peoples across the United States would have to become like Euro-Americans if they wanted to prosper or even to survive, that the indigenous way of life was one that was destined for failure.
To move toward a future that brings strength and prosperity to all, we don't need to forget what happened. We need to see it clearly and to understand. Prior to and after the 1862 Dakota War, there was much that was hidden from view. It was a confusing time with great suffering. Many, both Dakotas and the settlers, paid a high price and sacrificed much. We honor them by laying down our weapons, be they verbal, economic, or otherwise, and by learning to get along.
You had a whole society that couldn't necessarily differentiate between Dakota people who were being helpful to settlers, that were trying to avoid conflict, who were in some instances actively engaged in foiling their Dakota relatives in the war, and it makes me very sad.
It was tragic what happened to the Indians after the war, and it was also tragic what happened to the whites after the war.
I feel it's a tragedy for both sides. I mean, the whole thing is
A Clash of Cultures, Understanding the Dakota War of 1862 is a production of AMPRS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota Communities. The show was made possible through a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. A Clash of Cultures was written and produced by Milton Jamie Lee, with narration by Murray Lee.